gratitude is it fuels generosity, which opens to grace. And so I see this moment in our planetary, in our human history upon planet, in this moment of this trajectory, as a call of grace, as a call to open to that experience of unitary consciousness with the divine.
Hello, I'm Julie Kroll. You're listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. Each week we gather right here to make connections that break through the illusion of separation. Welcome. Your journey of conscious evolution continues right here, right now. When I say the word healing, what do you think of or imagine? Does something leap in your heart or stir in your soul? As a healer, some of the most profound cases I have ever worked with have been when the veils between heaven and earth dissolved and the designing intelligence of the universe stepped in miraculously. For myself personally, during intense periods of healing, whether physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual, it was the benevolent times when the physical and spiritual worlds unexpectedly came together and transcended all rational knowing and expectations. I talk about some of these experiences in my book, Fractured Grace. And we're going to play in this realm today. And I have to say, as we prepared for this show, there were so many other forces and energies moving. So I trust that this conversation is going to be so deep and meaningful. I'm looking forward to this. Listen to this opening paragraph from the book Shamanism by Oscar Miro Quesada. It's one of the books in the Common Sentience book series. He writes, "Today's shaman leaves new footprints on paths of psychic awareness and spiritual wisdom that are more than 70,000 years old. Shamanism is a tradition of healing, power, and wisdom that sees all life as interconnected and sacred. The process of shamanic awakening is as vast as the universe itself. Physical and spiritual worlds blend with one another, and the shaman's path lies in attaining a life of harmony with both." I'm happy to bring you this conversation in the Main Street Mystic series, so take a few conscious breaths, bring your awareness to your heart, relax and open your mind, settle into your essential wholeness as we introduce our guests. But first, my co-host, Dr. Paul Mills, is professor of public health and family medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He has over 400 scientific publications in the fields of pharmacology, oncology, cardiology, psychoneuroimmunology, behavioral medicine, and integrative health. He's the author of the book, Science, Being and Becoming, The Spiritual Lives of Scientists. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Julie. It's great to be together again. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce one of our guests, Dr. Shamini Jain. She's a psychologist, a scientist, and a social entrepreneur. She's the founder and CEO of the Consciousness and Healing Initiative, a nonprofit collaborative accelerator that connects scientists, health practitioners, educators, and artists to help lead humanity to heal ourselves. She's also adjunct faculty at the University of California, San Diego, where she's a member of the Centers for Integrative Health. Her best-selling book, Healing Ourselves, Biofield Science and the Future of Health, broke new ground about the human biofield and health, and is available from Sounds True Publications.
Yes, welcome, Shamini. And I have the pleasure of introducing our other guest, an internationally acclaimed shamanic teacher and healer, earth-honoring ceremonialist and author, Don Oscar Miro Quesada, is OAS Fellow in Ethnopsychology and a member of the Evolutionary Leaders Circle. He's been guiding ethno-spiritual pilgrimages to sacred sites of the world since 1986. He is founder of the Heart of the Healer Shamanic Mystery School and author of Shamanism, Personal Quests of Communion with Nature and Creation. Don Oscar is a popular faculty member at the Shift Network and educational centers in the USA and abroad, dedicating his life to the revitalization of Aboriginal wisdom traditions as a means of restoring sacred trust between humankind and the natural world. A seasoned navigator of non-ordinary states of consciousness, Don Oscar is well prepared to help people from all walks of life access realms of being through which multidimensional powers and forces are available for healing self, others, and our planetary ecosystem. And I loved sharing every word of that bio today, even though it was a little longer than normal, Don Oscar, because there's this psychology thread that goes through that links us to Chamonix. There's this, there was so much there. And this whole program is based on normalizing the non-ordinary. So then again, we're talking about non-ordinary states of consciousness. And we are just really honored to have both of you here with us for Main Street Mystics. Both of you, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Yeah. And I know the two of you are going to fall in love with each other. And I'm just really looking forward to this conversation to see where it goes. And Oscar, I'm going to start with you because we've had a traditional first question. And perhaps Chamonix can pipe in here too, because she just wrote a book that speaks to this whole thing. But I've had a traditional first question on the show for 10 years because this is a part of the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. And for 9.5 years have asked this very same question. And it's used to be that we were trying to prove all things were connected when we first began the show. And even scientists would come on and we would be giving information and really trying to connect the dots for people. And now it's like, oh, we don't have to anymore. It's like, oh, it just is. And so the answers to this question have been getting richer and deeper and more meaningful. And I'm just curious, because we're talking about shamanism, your new book, Oscar, if you could say, what does all things connected mean to you as a shaman?
Well, first of all, thanks for opening up the sacred space for us to explore this evolutionary potential within our human species, not only our individual souls. And aside from the incredible professional similarities among all of us, I also have a passion for surfing, having grown up in Peru and being an embodiment of the stoke. So I'm glad to share that. And life and shamanism and all the experience of connectivity and interdependence from a point of view of my own shamanic experience, and I can probably with confidence say the rest of the modern shamanic practitioners that have in a earnest manner derived their guidance from ancestral lineages of wisdom traditions known to especially the Amerindian peoples don't even contemplate anything but that state of wholeness, that experience of surrendered yearning to merging with the beauty and belongingness and beautification that comes with befriending blissfully being as our ultimate ground. And therefore, in other words, I have it, I have a difficult time experiencing life other than from my heart. Shamanism is a labor of love. It originated with the first human impulse to care for something equal or more than oneself. And out of that first impulse, that first reaching out to be of service, evolved a diverse pleroma or plethora of practices, ceremonial arts, and community building orientations toward ensuring that wherever there is a human grouping, That grouping takes its guidance from nature in a venerating and reverent manner. So therefore, the experience of reverence and loving service is key to the shamanic understanding of our interdependent wholeness as a species, as a planetary species. I trust that that is a suffices as a response to your opening question, my good sister.
It was beautiful. Thank you. And Chamonix, you just wrote a beautiful book yourself, Healing Ourselves, and you talk about the biofield, and I'm in love with your book too. I'm wondering if you want to add anything as we're looking at the show of really holding the spiritual wisdom traditions with the science, and we're looking at how all things are connected from the scientific perspective and your research on the biofield. I'm wondering what you might want to add, and then I'll turn this over to Paul for the first question.
You bet. Well, I mean, to add to the beautiful words that were just uttered is an honor, actually, to try to do. And honestly, Oscar, when you were speaking, I thought to my spiritual tradition and my ever-evolving experience as a human being. And so from the scientific side, as you know, many of us are fond of saying, why are we so excited about the biofield? Because it's showing our interconnection, right? In very deep and beautiful, profound ways that galvanize healing all the way down to our cells. So there's much to say from the scientific side. But if I draw from my own experience, then I say what resonates with me when I think of or experience interconnection is to see and honor the life energy that exists in all of us, everything and everyone. And nature is our biggest teacher, so we can honor the diversity of expression of this life force energy that literally permeates all of existence. And drawing from the Jan spiritual tradition, which is my spiritual home, it is also in that honoring that we choose to be nonviolent, right? To practice ahimsa, because honoring the life energy in all things means deliberately not harming and actually taking measures to prevent harm. Why? To foster flourishing for all beings and all things. And this is what I love about all of the spiritual traditions. There's so much resonance across our traditions in terms of how we recognize the non-separation, as I know you like to say, Paul.
I do. That's a beautiful introduction to our show. And Oscar, a question for you. And before I get into any questions about the life of a shaman, you write in your book about the shamanic call to awakening, or awakening to the shamanic soul, which I found very captivating. And reading that, it reminded me of what's often called the monomyth, or Joseph Campbell writes about the hero's journey and its different stages. So a couple of questions about that. One, who amongst us really gets to be a shaman? I imagine many are called, but not all make it. And maybe some people are more suited to become a shaman than others. Some maybe hear the call and respond. Others don't, maybe out of fear or ignorance or just other reasons. And within that, if you can also speak about what you called the initiatory crisis, a very important part of the shaman's call and their movement into this new life.
Well, 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 to properly respond to that inquiry, my good brother, will take a couple of days, yet I will do my best to reflect back so that your own experience of dismemberment at some moment in your life is remembered as an experience of awakening that brings together those disowned parts of oneself, the shadow, the denied aspects of self that one is fearful that if they share with others will result in being marginated and ostracized from the world at large. And that fear itself is what's behind our dilemma right now as the co-creators of a monomythic culture. Because I understand what Campbell says also, because I'm into plurality, into diversity, into an infinite creative possibility of growing a soul. And when I hear monomyth, it feels a bit too limiting. It feels like it has a boundary. It feels like it has some edges that, from a shamanic point of view, need to be dissolved, annihilated, vaporized, so that we can enter into the flow with the great breath, with the swaha, as they say in Hinduism, or the vaida, as we say in the Andes. So the shamanic initiation is experienced by many, yet followed as a heeding or heeded as a path of service and healing maturation of one's soul by very few. The reason being is that in this day and age, shamanism is trendy and everybody believes or experiences themselves of having the potential to become a shaman, just like people in the 50s and 60s practicing Eastern traditions dreamt of becoming enlightened and reaching that Buddhahood that is written about in the epic texts of the past. So therefore, I feel that we have to be very careful in answering a question like that, because as far as I have experienced in my own initiatory crisis that resulted then in a redefinition of what my life was about, its purpose, I had to go through many trials that I would have never survived. I would have probably entered into a state of psychotic disassociation because of the flooding of the amount of archetypal material that was entering into my psyche at the time. If I did not have a mentor, a teacher, well grounded in the traditions of our ancient ones, I would have lost my way. And I find that happening to many people when they're at that verge of heeding the call. So therefore, our life is a story, according to our shamanic peoples. And we have the blessing and curse of free will to help direct, write that story, become both playwriter and play, to fashion our relationship with a living, sentient cosmos. But that can only be done if we have a map. And to become a cartography of these unknown territories requires some trusted lineage in which we can situate our experiences so that they don't become obstacles rather than openings beyond that edge. So I hope that my response reflects our common experience, Paul. Thank you for the great question.
It does, Oscar. Thank you for it. And you've also addressed in part, I know many people have been seeking out such journeys, Westerners heading to Peru, ayahuasca, all kinds of ceremonies and seeking. And I'm just not sure they're always getting the kind of guidance they need, especially during those crucial times of crisis and reawakening.
It's a noble aspiration, though.
Yeah. It is indeed. It is indeed. We always have to proceed forward on our journey.
So let's talk about this, not only from the practitioner point of view, but from the receiving part of shamanic work, as there are increasing numbers of shamanic practitioners. I remember, in my early training as a psychotherapist and then an energy healer, those who were taking shamanic practitioner training versus really being called as a shaman. And one of my teachers who was a shaman, when I was studying under her, had a very clear boundary there of a shaman is a shaman. And I'm just teaching you. It was kind of like when I took Buddhist psychology training, and it was like, this isn't Buddhism. This is Buddhist psychology training. It's the same thing. Like, this isn't shamanism. You're not a shaman. This is a shaman practitioner training. And you write in the book, I love this one sentence, shamanism is the profession from which all modern medical doctors and ordained priests descend. And I love that because it holds what we're talking about with these spiritual traditions, the spiritual wisdom and the healing traditions. And we're holding them as equals here, saying this is where it comes from, is this shamanism. So I want to turn this over to you, Shamani. in your exploration of healing traditions. And let's just talk about those roles and how those Eastern traditions have really influenced us in especially the Western world, and maybe even glamorized, like you said, Paul, a lot of these techniques. Because one of the things that we've found on this show, we're looking at, why do we have mystical, transpersonal, metaphysical experiences? And what does the science say? What does the spiritual wisdom say? But what does our lived experience teach us? And one of the things that we have found is that there are those who can ground these kinds of experiences and integrate and function. And then there's the seekers too. There's a lot of seekers out there, like we were talking about, that is popular now. But there are those that can't ground it. And then I always say, as a psychotherapist or psychologist in the past, of saying they just blow fuses. Like literally, they can't contain that level of altered state and do go awry. And we had a show on that in the series that was really helpful, I think. So, Shamini, I'm wondering if you could speak to that from your exploration with the research, when we're beginning to integrate some of these mystical experiences and the energy healing into what we call contemporary medicine now, and what that really looks like as we move forward.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Julie. And I think you mentioned also, you know, maybe drawing from the Eastern spiritual tradition, some comparative exploration here. So a couple of caveats. One, I describe myself as a recovering academic. So I think many of you can relate to that. And I would also describe myself as a lifelong student. So with those caveats, you know, I know this much really as an academic about shamanism, and probably this much also as a lifelong student. There's much, much to learn. But what strikes me from my personal experience, just again, as a layperson, you can say, growing up in the East Indian spiritual traditions and doing my own exploration of those, not as an academic scholar in those traditions, like Paul, my background is in psychoneuroimmunology and psychology, so we can get to that. But one thing that I deeply appreciate in the amount that I have learned so far about these beautiful traditions of shamanism, and my dear brothers and sisters who really help us to understand the beauty of the interconnection between all things, but particularly with nature, is that honestly, when I was growing up in my traditions, that discussion was kind of missing, right? I grew up in traditions where I picked up books where they were mostly written by male monks, and it was sort of like, getting married is bad, women are bad, you know, you must strive for self-realization. That is, you know, to transcend the senses, which was often described as denying the senses, you know, which I don't think is really what the ancient scriptures meant. But to your point also about overload, one thing was very, very clear. So obviously, even as a young woman, I had opinions about some of the things they were saying and questioned the truth of what they were saying in the way that they were describing, you know, marriage as being bad and women being bad and all that. It's like, what is this about? But one thing that they did say is, if your goal ultimately is self-realization, then many of the siddhis, the powers, even the experience of broad and deep connection can often be viewed as a distraction, right? And so what I noticed growing up here in the Western world, and I would say at this point, the global world, not even the Western world, is there is a lot of emphasis on superpowers, you know, develop and grow your superpowers, and, you know, a lot of fascination with the siddhis. And I think that's very normal, because we're all striving to explore these non-ordinary states of consciousness in a world that really wants to put us in some real tunnel vision, you know, tunneling of our being. So all of that is fine. But, you know, as I have explored this for both myself, with my clients, with my students, I think about what those traditions have said about, what's your ultimate goal? What's your ultimate goal? And depending on where your ultimate goal is, where should your focus be? Because if it's just kind of more, you know, more energy, you know, less aging, I want to be young forever, I want all of these superpowers, I want to be psychic, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but it may not bring you peace. It may actually be a barrier to your full realization. Why? Because we're attached now, right? Now we're attached. And so I think there is some wisdom that we can draw from those traditions when we start exploring all of these beautiful aspects of our being, these different archetypes that we connect with that are us, right? That we can explore when we're exploring strong medicine. And nature itself, I would say, is strong medicine, whether you're speaking of imbibing plant medicine or not. Nature is strong medicine. Nature tells us the truth. So we better be prepared to hear it. So, you know, I think that's part of our role here is to explore, are there also gentle ways to receive this message in ways that we can be gentle with ourselves, gentle with our journey, gentle with each other, so that integration isn't as hard as it has to. It doesn't have to be that hard.
That was beautiful, Chamonix. And I think in many ways you were describing the journey of the soul and the different challenges that come along and decision points. And that brings to mind for me, one of the questions I have for you, Oscar, is how do shamans understand the nature of the soul? What is it? Its origins, its relationship to the Godhead, to the living universe at large. Can you speak about that? And before you do, I almost forgot, when Julie was doing the invocation, I had the clearest image and feeling of this giant raven just came right down behind me and just sat right here. So it was a beautiful experience. So thank you for that, Julie, and you, Oscar, too, because it's all of us together and Chamonix.
I just would like to dovetail by on what Chamonix just shared by sharing a saying that has bubbled up in me some years back, which is when we surrender the need to figure it all out and cultivate the ability to let it all in, then our earth walk becomes a sacred dance of healing service upon planet. More than saving, our world needs loving. In terms of that raven that surfaced in your consciousness, that is a validation of the fact that you do approach your own spiritual path, your sadhana, from a place of love, from a place of compassion, from a place of complete embrace, like a lover would embrace the loved one. In similar fashion, shamanism, when it relates to consciousness, sees no distinction between consciousness as awareness, both on an individual atmic level and on a Brahmic universal level, as soul, as the individual soul, as the anima mundi, as the world soul, and as the cosmic soul that reveals itself through creation's dreaming of the multiplicity of forms that we can experience both in our spiritual and material lives. So therefore, consciousness being soul, we have five axioms that I've distilled in shamanism that I believe will add to the richness of this already rich conversation. The first axiom is that consciousness begets matter. And by begets, I mean informs, structures, makes manifest the material world. Nothing new for people like us and for our listening audience, obviously. The second axiom is that language begets reality. The words we use creates this field in which we're experiencing ourselves interacting in our three-dimensional, sensory-dependent physical being. The third axiom is that ritual, and this is very important, ritual begets relationship. If you notice the natural world, our animal relatives, our plant relatives, there's an order, there's a pattern, there's a pulse, there's a tonality. Everything has it's an inducing of order out of chaos. And that is relationship. It's a sacred relationship with an emergent universe or multiverse. The fourth axiom is that nature begets purpose. Observe nature, and you will see what you're doing here incarnated in this physical container for. Because in similar fashion to the natural world, we have phases, we have stages in our development, and ultimately death returns to us what life took away. And the fifth most important axiom is that love begets life. And capital L love, of course. And that is the essence of shamanic healing, helping others and yourself restore the birthright of wholeness when you're experiencing a fragmented earthwalk. So, in answer to your question, Paul, in shamanism, in my humble opinion, there's no difference between soul and consciousness, capital C.
Tell us more about a fragmented earthwalk, and then I want to expand on this idea in a second, but I think that's what you said just now, Oscar, a fragmented earthwalk. Is that what you said?
I did, indeed.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Our estrangement from the sacred dimensions of life result in a fragmented experience of our relationship to others, our relationship to the natural world, our relationship to society. It becomes almost an obsessive search for survival rather than integration. And that leads to a separation between, at least I can speak from my own personal experience at the time when I felt fragmented, a separation of my own creative nature with the possibility of creating as a contribution to the species-wide, to the well-being of the species-wide web of life. I was only focused on how I can contribute to myself, what was going to give me the prestige and the acclaim that I needed to be able to reach out to others, not so much in selfless service in the sense of being a devotee of Hanuman, but as a self-centered, narcissistic, self-serving buffoon. And as Shamani said earlier, my background was in academics also, and I've gone through wearing the hats of clinical psychologists. I've done a lot of anthropology, all that stuff. I've done that route. And I realized that a donkey with a load of books is still a donkey, as a sophism. And so therefore, I decided to go ahead and surrender that, but at the same time, find creative joy in being able to use language to beget the reality around myself in service to the ritual beautification of life as a whole. So fragmentation to me is an opportunity to remember my wholeness.
Hmm. Go ahead, Paul. You look like you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do, because you're speaking, Oscar, about overcoming the fragmentation, moving into healing, essentially, as part of your path and of course, others. And so I'm going to speak a bit about healing and shamani. Specifically, you know more about shamanism than you're saying. One of the things you know about shamans is they use many different types of sounds for healing, including singing, right? Our dear friend, Dr. Joe Chaffours, taught us a lot about the Shipibo Indians of Peru and the Ikros that they sing for individual healing during ceremony. And many of your own teachings are around sounds that heal, including you use very specific mantras from your own tradition and I think other traditions. And I think it'd be nice to hear about your work with mantras and how that ties into your broader understanding of healing of the human being, the biofield, and so forth.
Thank you, Paul. And you know what? It's beautiful because we can tie it into all of this very lovely, juicy teaching that Oscar just shared with us around these five facets of shamanism as he described them, right? The first being consciousness begetting matter and language creating reality. And here we see these beautiful confluences again of our ancient teachings where we can really explore what the power of sound is with this, right? What is that about? And how do those all relate? So we know from many ancient traditions that we understood sound to be consciousness. In the Vedic tradition, we describe this as para. Sometimes people will call it para shakti, right? And what is that? It is the all. It is the oneness. It is the capital C consciousness. It is the soul, as Oscar just described. And then how does that begin to parse in the worldly reality that, you know, we're all kind of mostly talking about and living in, right? Again, drawing from those Vedic traditions, very precise descriptions of these different layers of sound that we are in, that we can literally open our consciousness to through our intentional divine sound making. And of course, this is where the mantras come in. So, you know, okay, I guess, like I said, I'm a recovering academic. So the academic aspect of me wants to now list those four aspects of sound for the other academically inclined people who want to know. Now I want to know what those four layers are. So the first being para, we talked about that, right? And then the next being pashanti, the experience of sound as light, which we may experience, right? And then madhyama, the experience of sound as subtle vibration, which I believe many of us have experienced, right? And then finally, vekari, which is the sound of my voice hitting the cilia in your ears and triggering brain responses and, you know, the audible pressure waves and all of that. So it's useful for us to explore that because it opens us even more to the experience and the power of sacred word, sacred sound in so many traditions. And of course, when we choose to focus our energy, even if we're just emitting a vowel, right, there is this sacredness of connection that we are feeling with that consciousness in our sound making. What kind of connection? We were talking about connecting, first defragmenting, we're defragging, right, with the sound. We're using the sound to defrag ourselves and cohere our biofield, right, our own personal field that we're in contact with. But really, it's an expansion where we can then begin to bring those divine aspects of being more fully into our field and gain the information and co-create in the shamanistic path as Oscar described it, because we're never alone. We've already established that, right? All things interconnected, all beings interconnected. And so these mantras, the Ikaros, you know, all of these beautiful ways that could be used to expand our healing journey and the healing journey of others, and certainly have been used for thousands and thousands of years in so many traditions. So I like to remind people that we all have this ability and the power. And, you know, people are often so shut down with the voice and the ability to just speak. This isn't just about speaking our truth, but it's also listening. And part of that is just the willingness to explore sound in our bodies as the first step. So indeed, Paul, it's a joy. I love teaching that work. It's so much fun.
So as I'm listening to you, Shamini, too, I'm just thinking about, I had a conversation with Irvin Laszlo yesterday and Elizabeth Satoris and Jude Curvin. Like, it was like the science, right? Like, it was like the science was right here. And like remnants of our conversation were flowing in and out of those conversations as I, you know, it's just like echoing here about healing. I want to kind of expand this healing, as we're talking about healing, into our collective healing and where we're at on the planet. And that was the experience I had reading the book. And both Paul and I said, Oscar, the book is so beautifully written. Your words are poetic and your words are medicine. Like the how it's written and the content is so beautiful. And I loved those five shamanic principles. They're highlighted with yellow in my book, and they're like go back there. I want to. And as like, because the very first one, consciousness begets matter, is exactly what I was talking about with Elizabeth, with Irvin Laszlo, with Jude Curvan yesterday. Like, consciousness begets matter. And they all see from the science that consciousness is a unified field. There's only one. Like, we don't have consciousness. We don't have mind and consciousness. We are. We and the whole world are mind and consciousness. So I'm going to share what happened to me preparing for this show, Oscar, and get your feedback on this. And I'd love all of you to jump in, because I usually have a ritual of preparation for every show and begin that and prepping by reading the book, and then like how I put I call it the formatics of the show together. And today I was in there, and as I was reviewing the book again, I was so aware of those who are stepping up as planetary healers. And we've just spent months with many of them who have literally said, okay, I'm dedicating the rest of my life to this. How can I show up? And we have this, I hate to put polarizing language in here, and I don't want to, but we have those who are very interested in the action. Let's get busy. Let's get to work down to the brass tacks. How do we get this done? And then there are those who say we create the coherence. Shamini, you just talked about coherence in our body and coherence in our biofield. And there are so many that are dedicated to coherence on the planet of we create this coherence with this consciousness that begets matter and it heals. And as I was reading your words, Oscar, it was like, I'm going back to that second camp going, all we have to do is come into that coherent space and love the planet, just like you mentioned to us. Let's all be lovers of the planet and it will heal the planet because love begets life. So I went back into that when I was preparing for the show and I went to those five things and I was sitting in there with these very impassioned people who are showing up to do this work on the planet right now. And I went on a journey. Like I lost 2 hours today. It was initiated by the essential instruction that none of us can move forward without ceremony first. Yay. I see Oscar. Yeah, I can't wait for you to jump in here. But it was like, hello, we have to stop and orient around ceremony first. And we met in Sedona and had a gathering and there was elements of ceremony, but it was clear that Oscar has to lead us as a collective, if we're all in now, into the shamanic healing ceremony for our collective healing. And it was so profound. Like I said, then I went and elements of the ceremony were there. You were with me. You all four were with me. All three of you, all four of us were there. And then I don't know where I went the rest of the 2 hours. It was just gone today. So Oscar, I'm going to invite you in here. When we talk about our collective healing, healing in behalf of our planet and love begets life, I'm curious how we move from consciousness to abundant life right now through that and what you would say about our collective healing on the planet right now.
To answer your question, we have to go on a shamanic journey in a sense like you went, because it is that experience of unbounded consciousness that comes from a true encounter with reverence for life on an individual level that elicits the most profound transformation that is necessary to serve. Unless you serve yourself through your own self-transformative lifestyle, you're going to be a servant of the great work, but just a servant, not a co-creator. And the key is becoming co-creative agents in the birthing of a prophecy, Taripaipacha, an era of re-encounter in which all people from all walks of life, ideological persuasions, cultural leanings, come together and break bread at the table of the Pachayachachi, the world teacher, which is none other than oneself as a liberated soul from the flesh. That doesn't mean that we transcend the world. On the contrary, when we're into that place of reverent, expanded presence, capital P, the I am, or the Nyokani, that essential self, is given its sovereignty and its room to play wildly in the world. And that service, that's the transformational power that will change things, because it's through that example that others will be stimulated or, you know, inspired to do some inner work themselves. That said, imagine a lot of people who have gotten to that place, such as the four of us, gathered at a sacred site, an ancestral temple ground, in a pattern formation that our ancient ones have used since time immemorial, known in both Eastern and Western Hermetic traditions, mystery schools, and most importantly, within shamanic traditions of the Americas, in which we can go ahead and ritually form a unified body that is not seeking to be the sole source of changing the way we've lost the way we've lost ourselves in the world, but is just feeding the psyche, the bioetheric or biofield of our sentient living earth with that resonance and allowing her to do the magic for us, which she's very capable of. So it's a balance between surrender and practice, between letting go and activism, but in the sense of being guided by an understanding, a gnosis, a shamanic gnosis, a realization that we're all on this, that the greatest game in life is showing up, like you said, in your own way, yet guided by the traditions of our tribal peoples that are known to have maintained cohesion, unity, and belongingness in relationship to a nature-venerating way of living known as the original instructions, because there are native peoples that did not act that way and were ruthless. We cannot be naive and think that all our indigenous forefathers or foremothers were blissful, compassionate beings. There were a lot of human nature is very varied. So we have to approach how to make this change by honoring those misguided souls within our ceremonial action without exclusion, and at the same time modeling the change we want to be, as Gandhi says. Ceremonial arts are key. That's what I was born to do and shall continue to do in this and many other bardos.
So we need to talk after the show, Oscar, and bring that into this place. And Shamini, I'm just thinking about the biofield too, and just as we're thinking about planetary healing, and we know about non-local and you know, even Reiki on an individual, but for the collective, it is about this, these subtle energies, this field, whether we're calling it the, you know, going into the ceremonial and sacred sites, or really we know prayer works. Why? Because of this biofield and non-locality. I'm just wondering if you want to add anything to this idea about our collective healing now on the planet.
I mean, I feel that Oscar's description was so beautifully resonant and complete. I mean, it really was. And Oscar, I just want to say, I so align with you with what you said about the difference between being a servant or a servant leader and a co-creator. And to emphasize for all of us that this really truly is a joyful process. And that's not bypass, right? But when we do what Oscar is saying, when we actually come into reverent presence with whatever we want to call it, the all, with nature herself, and we allow for this communication with the collective, so the collective is literally feeding us. Guess what? We all have these beautiful gifts. Oscar just committed to doing ceremonial practice with us for lifetimes. Thank you very much, Oscar. And each of us have these gifts, right? So that's the joy. That's the dharma. And it's not like, oh, what's my purpose? I got to find my purpose. I got to go take a class to figure out what my purpose is. No, your being is your purpose. So when you come into reverent presence, you're already in connection. Then everything just flows and it's very, very joyful. And that doesn't mean that we don't address things as they come up. You know, we talk about karma. What is karma? It's thoughts, words, and deeds. Thoughts, words, deeds. We already established language creates reality. So we understand that. What are the deeds? We can serve in many ways, but if we're resentful and if we're angry, we're working against ourselves. We're working against the planet. So I'm a bothist, right? I'm a both and person, Julie. I don't think that we have to just simply gather to come into coherence and just sing to each other, right? But we sing for the world. And the energy that we gather in that reverent connection allows us to have to carry the co-creative energy to do the work, which sometimes is difficult. And that's okay. But we do it with joy because we're doing it. We're always in communion, right? So when we're moving with the energy of communion for co-creation, and, you know, speaking of where we draw resource with each other, certainly there are studies already showing that. There's a reason why Thich Nhat Hanh, the venerable late Thich Nhat Hanh, has said that a person without a sangha or a spiritual community is like a drop of rain in the desert. There's a reality to that. And in fact, Paul can tell you about a study that he was deeply involved in where we just published what happens to us energetically when we encounter sacred space and sacred objects. So we just recently published a paper, for example, showing when we come into these beautiful places of worship where there is that honoring, there is that reverence, and even us as relatively naive people that might come into a new area that's not even necessarily of our culture, but we stand in reverent presence and we say something like, Durga Devi Sharanam, I take refuge in the Mother. And we stand in that place that has been literally created with that coherent energy. Our biofield changes. Our photons of light actually change as they are emitted off of us. So it is very real. It's very palpable. It's even a bit measurable.
We did measure it, didn't we?
We did, Paul, thanks to the great work that you and Tiffany did. Thank you for that.
Beautiful summation of what is known as the Pachakuti, P-A-C-H-A-K-U-I-T-I, which in Quechua or the Runasimi, the mouth of the people, means Pacha, world, time, space, place, ultimately consciousness, and Kuti, reversal, transformation, renewal. We understand that everything is in a state of flux. Everything is in a state of transformative emergence. And therefore, there's no difference between that on an individual scale or a planetary scale. Our planet and its biosphere goes, just like our human skin, goes through these periods of deep shedding of what's not life-sustaining. And so therefore, the Pachakuti, from a point of view of aligning the personal, the interpersonal, the transpersonal dimensions of human experience, is a vital moment, a rite of passage, a moving through into a place in which we can be both witness and the witnessed of this momentous period that we are reaching an apex with, really. We understand in the prophecies of our Indian mystical people, traditions, for instance, that we are on the verge of, to use a common cliche, a breakdown that leads to a breakthrough. And that the way to attenuate the destructive fallout from this is to gather at our ancestral sacred sites, and if not, to create a sacred site out of your own walk, out of your own beauty walk of reverence into any natural place of in the world, and offer what we know as mihushanku, a ritual feeding of gratitude and of appreciation for the gift of life, with cornmeal, with tobacco, with pollen, with whatever plant, you know, medicine that you have available, and if not, with your own heart, by simply laying down on the earth and crying your tears of joy and pain into the Mother that so graciously receives them. Gratitude it fuels generosity, which opens to grace. And so I see this moment in our planetary, in our human history upon planet, in this moment of this trajectory, as a call of grace, as a call to open to that experience of unitary consciousness with the divine. And the best way to do that is by gathering together, sustained by the sanctity of the natural world, for the creation of heartfelt sacred community dedicated to the great work. That would be my response.
I got nothing. That was so very beautiful and inspiring, including that you laid out that really every single human being, no matter who they are, no matter where they live, they could go out and do some of these activities that help move us forward towards the restoration of the three worlds to this original harmony.
Beautiful. And the quote that I wrote down is, gratitude opens to generosity, which fuels grace. Like, how beautiful is that?
Gratitude fuels generosity, which opens to grace.
Which opens to grace. I wrote it down backwards. Gratitude fuels generosity, which opens to grace. Thank you for correcting me.
That understanding came at one of our EO retreats, in-person retreats, where I was able to offer some ceremony. I missed the one in June. I wish I was there.
It makes so much sense from an energy perspective, right? Or a biofield perspective, what Oscar has just shared.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that makes sense, so I'm going to try to encourage us to wrap up here. I could go another hour, but when you were talking about the personal, interpersonal, transpersonal, we've set out in this series, Main Street Mystics, to ask why, what is the purpose of transpersonal, metaphysical, and mystical experiences? And I'm just wondering if we could close by any of us jumping in here. What is the purpose of these? What does it tell us about humanity's potential and humanity's future? Anybody want to jump in? Shamini.
My quickest answer is just to remember who we are. It's really that simple, to remember who we really are.
Beautiful. Oscar?
To give yourself permission to wildly take it to the streets, to embody the transpersonal bliss that comes with a life free of fear, doubt, and insecurity.
Wonderful. Paul, do you want to jump in?
The encouragement that all of our listeners take up this path so they begin to explore, if they haven't already, the meaning of their own deep inner metaphysical and mystical experiences. To begin that journey if they're not there already and come more into their own and make the contributions that we've been speaking about during this program for this kind of redemption and awakening of humanity and our contribution to the earth herself and really to the cosmos beyond, which you also write about in your book and the shamanic cosmology sections, which I really appreciated, Oscar.
Yeah, what a beautiful show. I am just so tickled to have both of you with us and really appreciate all the contributions today. Thank you both for joining us. Shamini, Oscar, thank you so much. And listeners, thank you for joining us. I want to leave you with the words of Don Oscar here. Aligned in principle and purpose with these wisdom teachings, we can now confidently decree our willingness to become a hollow bone, an instrument of healing light in divine partnership with creation. In doing so, our lives effortlessly hold space for our deaths and rebirths, helping midwife us out of our sticky cocoon of ignorance and giving us refuge for self-transformation and the joyous flowering of our shamanic souls. I'm Julie Kroll. You've been listening to the Dr. Julie Show, All Things Connected. This is the Main Street Mystic Series with co-host Paul J. Mills. Remember, together, we are creating connections for the good of the whole. Until next time, we're sending you a world of love. Bye for now. If you enjoyed the show, go to your favorite podcast platform. Remember to subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. Also, please consider supporting the Dr. Julie Show at patreon.com/allthingsconnected. When we each give a little, we all get a little more. You can stay in touch with me at juliekrollemail.com. Thanks for listening.